So CNB and performance, a review of empirical findings. We're going to go through a few empirical this time studies. So far most of the time we've been talking about theories, we've been talking about models or less structured theoretical arguments about how things should be. Today we're going to have a look at how things really are and see whether the theories behind compensation and benefits are verified. And is there anything in the data that goes beyond the corpus of simple theories that we use in making sense of CNB? So one purpose of today's lecture is basically is to compare the theory and the data, whether they look like each other. And the second part of today's lecture is to, you know, try and spread the message of a more practical nature, if you like, that whatever you want to do with CNB, whatever management policies firms want to implement regarding their compensation and benefits practices, these policies have to be thought through and analyzed before by looking for empirical evidence behind the workings of these policies. So the policy is not to be implemented just because. The policy is to be implemented when there is a strong empirical case that advocates its implementation in this particular setting. So we will look at the effects of individual incentives, we will look at the effects of indirect incentives when you incentivize another principal rather than the agent. We will look at the differential effects of positively versus negatively framed incentives, and we will, if time allows, we will also have a look at a very interesting question strongly rooted in psychology and behavioral economics, namely the question, can you actually over-provide incentives? Can incentives be too strong for their own good? So do people freak out when they meet very strong incentives? And the short answer is yes, they do. Not only do they freak out, they also engage themselves in unproductive and nefarious activities such as sabotage, for instance. Now, so if this is one thing you need to know from this lecture, there is not one thing you need to know from this lecture, but if you are memory challenged, and one thing you've got to remember from this lecture, this is going to be this. Edward Lazier is a very classical work with thousands of citations. One thing that one needs to know about compensation and benefits is the paper by Edward Lazier. Please download it. It's available everywhere. Those who participated in my incentive seminar have heard a lot about it. Those who are not participating in my incentive seminar, please download it and read it. This is Clausur relevant. So, okay. Now, this is a classical study on the effects of individual incentives. This is the first study from which we learn that, about the existence of such things as incentive effect and sorting effect. These two effects we studied in theory 2 weeks ago. It's a field experiment with a real firm called Safe Light Glass Corporation, whose management in early 90s decided to move from hourly rate to piece rate. So in early 90s, most of the firms practiced hourly rate or daily rate or monthly fixed wage, and incentives, well, it's not to say that incentives did not exist. Of course, incentives did exist. Efficiency wages, for instance, and bonus payments to managers. But incentives to line employees were not as widely spread as they are now. So this was really new thing. The management decided to implement a piece rate compensation scheme rather than hourly rate compensation scheme. They met, of course, the resistance from the trade union, who said, look, we don't want to lose out from your management experiments. They said, don't worry, if your actual earnings given our piece rate are below your normal rate, we will compensate. So the linear incentive scheme that Lazier tried out is not really the linear incentive scheme, is not exactly the linear incentive scheme that we studied in the theory lecture. In the theory lecture, we studied a linear incentive scheme in which you had in which you had a fixed wage that you would be paid no matter what, and then on top of this fixed wage you'll be paid a piece rate for every unit of output that you produce. Here it's very important to understand that it's more like a target. It's more like a target bonus incentive scheme that he tried out. So if you end up producing less than the quantity that would give you your normal hourly fixed wage, then you will be paid your normal hourly fixed wage. Now, starting from the output that when priced at the piece rate will go beyond your hourly fixed wage, you will get whatever is above your hourly fixed wage as the incentive. So it's a sort of fixed wage, target, and then the bonus as well, and then the piece rate. Okay, so I don't feel like drawing lots of pictures here, because when you read the paper, when you do read the paper, you'll see exactly what I mean. So I said it's an experiment, and it's very important, because if you just compare the performance of firms that do have incentives versus the performance of the firms that don't have incentives, you will very well find that the firms that do have incentives are more productive than firms that don't have incentives. Now, does that necessarily mean that incentives are good for productivity? The answer is no, it does not necessarily mean that incentives are good for productivity, because, those of you who studied econometrics will realize that the introduction of incentive schemes in firms may be endogenous to unobserved characteristics of the firm, such as unobserved productivity. You can have a firm with very retrograde and not qualified managers who don't know this incentives literature, and they would do things the old way, the way they know, versus you may have a firm in which managers are very highly educated, sort of upward looking, qualified, well-read, etc., and they may have heard about incentives, they may have experienced incentives firsthand, that it's a good thing, and may implement them. So the effect of incentives from comparing these two firms is a sort of sum of the effects of incentives proper and the effects of better managers, better management that is conducive to implementing incentive schemes. So that's why you need an exogenous event, an event whereby incentives are introduced regardless of the quality of management in a particular firm or in a particular workplace. So here was this event. The management of Safelite Glass Corporation decided to implement the piece rate compensation. They probably were good managers. The way they decided to implement it introduced exogenous variation. What was the way in which they decided to implement the incentive scheme? They decided to start with the workplaces closer to the headquarters. So they had headquarters, and in the workplaces that were closer, they decided to introduce incentives first. And the workplaces that were a little bit farther away from their headquarters, they would have their incentive pay scheme introduced later. So the variation in the timing, there was variation in the timing of the introduction of incentive schemes in different workplaces, and this variation was the identifying variation for the effect of incentives on performance. Now, is this variation exogenous or endogenous to performance? It's a good question. Assuming that the performance of the workplaces is independent of their geographic location with respect to the company's headquarters. Under this assumption, the variation in the timing of incentive pay introduction is exogenous. If this assumption does not hold, there needs to be a good argument why this assumption does not hold, then this variation is endogenous, and we're back to the problem that I explained a couple of minutes ago. So throughout this study, it was maintained that this variation was exogenous, and this assumption is rather uncontroversial. Now, the results are very, very strong, and some people find them hard to believe. Now, the effect of incentives, the effect of piece rate incentives documented by Edward Lazier in this particular case, Safelite Glass Corporation, was a whopping 44%. So the productivity in terms of the number of windscreens installed by an average employee before and after, the productivity effect was 44%, right? Can you imagine? It's huge. It's a lot of money. Now, it was a win-win because not only is the productivity increased, also the wages increased, so the workers did get something of the output that they created. There were no losses in quality, so people did increase the quantity of output, but the negative effects on quality were somehow avoided. Now, given this huge results that not everybody believes, by the way, but if you assume that it's really, you know, the sort of typical effect of incentives when you introduce them, it begs a question, and this question permeates the large and still growing literature on the effect of incentives on performance. If incentives are so cool, why not all firms adopt incentives? Yeah? We have approached this question from the theoretical standpoint. And if you may remember, 2 weeks ago or 3 weeks ago, we had two lectures on incentives, and we were talking about firm size, we were talking about uncertainty, we were talking about observability of output as the fundamental determinants of whether or not it makes sense to introduce incentives. There is some discussion in this paper about why not all firms adopt piece rate. And basically the bottom line is, unsurprisingly, that piece rate, linear incentives are not first best in the case of risk-averse workers. That you also know from the theoretical part of the course. And what you also know and what we're going to learn right now is that there are alternatives to worker incentive compensations. If you don't see the 0-1 variable, whether the firm does or does not have incentives, it doesn't mean that the firm doesn't practice incentives. The firm may practice incentives just in a different way. So one such way of practicing incentives, which is not piece rate incentives, is to do monitoring, right? And we've learned a little bit about monitoring, and we will learn a lot more about monitoring when we have our performance evaluation lecture. And another way to do incentives, an alternative to incentivizing workers, is to incentivize managers, right? So let's have a look at what happens when you incentivize managers. Now, the naive, very simple economic theory would predict that when you introduce incentives to managers, not a lot is going to happen. Why not? Because the managers are managing workers, whereas the workers are creating the output. So if you cannot observe a worker's effort as the principal, what's the point of incentivizing another principal who cannot observe the worker's effort either, right? So, here is a very famous paper by a very famous trio of economists, prize-winning, award-winning economists. This is also a compulsory reading for this course. Please make sure you read this paper. This is a case, a very famous paper in the literature, that looks at the effects of incentivizing managers. Yeah? And the theory there is the following, right? So why does it make sense to incentivize managers? It is true that the principal does not observe the agent's effort, but the signal of the agent's effort and the agent's ability that different principals receive may also be different, right? So the rector of the University of Constance, right, he is my principal. I am his agent. Does he observe my effort? He sort of does, a little bit, with very, very large noise, right? He can look at my student evaluation results. He can look at my publications. He will not observe a lot of other aspects of my effort just because there are several layers of hierarchy between us, right? My head of department is also my other principal. It's not that a given agent has only one principal. You can have several principals and several agents working under several principals, right? So different principals may have different observations about the agent's effort, and some principals may have a better idea, a more precise signal of the agent's effort. And so if you have a multi-principal situation in which there is a higher level principle and a lower level principle and the agent, then the higher level principle may incentivize the lower level principle so as to provide incentives for this lower level principle to invest more effort in monitoring and managing the agent, right? And it's going to work. It could work, right? Why can it work? Because this lower level principle has a better idea about what the agent is doing. So here's, as I said, a very famous study in which instead of incentivizing workers, the authors incentivized managers. So, and a little bit about the context of this study. It's a very basic working environment. Students from Eastern European countries coming to Britain, to Wales, to pick strawberries for a couple of weeks during their summer vacation. Backbreaking work, picking strawberries, wage next to minimum, but you know, some experience of visiting Britain and living on the farm and having fun, etc. So this is a fruit picking company, and they had the students who picked strawberries. They had field managers, who are going to be very important for our story, and there was the chief operating officer, the boss, the higher level principal. Okay, now, so there are lots of people around living on the farm, and not everyone will end up being recruited to pick strawberries. So on some days, I may be hired to pick strawberries, and I will receive my wages per kilogram of strawberries or per hour, whatever. On another day, I might not be recruited, right? So the experiment was about changing the compensation of the managers and the boss. Now, the boss is not very important for our story. The managers are much more important. So the workers received piece rate. The managers received fixed pay plus bonus. And the bonus was a function of the average worker productivity. Right, so the managers thereby got incentives from the principal, from the owners of the company, to invest more effort in monitoring their workers, the you know fruit pickers, to make sure that they pick strawberries rather than walk around, to make sure that they don't jam too many strawberries, that they invest more effort in picking strawberries where there are strawberries rather than just walking around, and so on and so on. Now, here are some data, some descriptive statistics, which offer a first glimpse on the effect of this treatment. So these are the descriptive statistics under the two conditions, the control condition when people were paid just fixed wages, managers were paid fixed wages, and the treatment condition when field managers were paid a performance bonus on top of the fixed wages. And as you can see, the worker productivity is significantly higher in the treatment condition. So you had higher productivity per hour, but because there is a fixed amount of strawberries on the field, now that your workers are more productive, you don't need as many workers. So there is an increase in individual productivity. There is a decrease in the number of workers per field day. There is obviously an increase in unemployment. When there is an increase in unemployment on the farm, people would go and earn lower wages, those who are selected in employment. So it's not a win-win, like in the Lazier world, right? So some people have lost by being unemployed, other people have lost by earning lower wages. The greedy capitalist fruit-picking company won a lot in terms of getting higher productivity per hour worked, and for this hour they actually ended up paying less. Wow. Okay, but let us not get too carried away. Let us be scientific. These are regression results, which basically show a 20% or thereabout, you know, give or take 20% increase in productivity once managerial bonus is introduced. It's very robust to various specifications. That's the whole point of this slide. But you know, the most interesting thing about this study, which I invite you to study very well and imprint in your memories because it's going to be very, very Clausur relevant, is to look at the mechanisms that deliver this massive 20% increase in worker productivity. And these mechanisms are two. So what are the two ways in which you can raise productivity? Right? So one way you can raise productivity without doing the work yourself, is to spend more management effort, is to spend more time trying to monitor and manage workers who are relatively more productive, right? So if I have 10 workers working for me, some are useless, some are very productive. Now that I have incentives, how can I increase the total output and thereby increase the chances of winning a bonus? I will relocate my time from the useless people who will not create a lot of output, and I will spend a lot more time trying to manage people who are less useless. This is what they call the targeting effect. Now, how do we find whether this targeting effect actually is activated and how large this targeting effect is? To do so, the authors ran quantile regression. And I take it that everybody knows what quantile regression is. It's a sort of intermediate level econometrics. Quantile regression? Anyone? Quantile regression? No? So, anyone, quantile regression? Median regression? Minimum distance estimator? No? Okay, so read up. Wikipedia has excellent article on quantile regression. Now, it's a master level course, right? You have to read things other than your lecture slides. But it's actually not very difficult. Let me give you a crash course on quantile econometrics. So the typical basic regression analysis would run a linear regression of y on x, right? So what is a linear regression? Linear regression is a representation of conditional mean of the dependent variable as a linear function of the x's, right? Remember this? Yeah? Now, but you don't have to limit your econometrics to only expressing a conditional mean of the distribution as a function of x's. You can also express conditional other characteristics of the distribution. You can do conditional variance, for instance, and this gives you this Garch and Arch models that are used in financial econometrics. Now, what the quantile regression does, quantile regression expresses conditional quantiles of the distribution as a linear function of x. Now, why is this an appropriate method here? Well, this is the quantile of the these are the quantiles of the productivity distribution of the fruit-picking workers before managerial incentives were introduced. Now, how can you estimate individual productivity? Well, individual productivity is basically the fruit picker fixed effect. If you have several observations for the same fruit picker, you average them out, and this average will give you the worker fixed effects. Now, your fixed effect may belong to the bottom percentile of the distribution, or it may belong to the top percentile distribution. Here are the very excellent fruit pickers, and here are the very bad fruit pickers, okay, in terms of their productivity before incentives were introduced. Now, they looked at the treatment effects depending on where the fruit pickers belonged in terms of the initial productivity distribution. And what they found was that if you happen to have a team with lots of workers who are relatively more productive, then the treatment effect is going to be way higher than if you have a team in which the workers are, you know, have very bad initial productivity levels. Now, this finding, you would say, well, it's trivial. It's not so trivial, because remember that this is a story about incentivizing managers rather than incentivizing workers. The workers are already incentivized. They already get a piece rate, right? And if they get a piece rate, they already have their incentive constraint binding. Right, so they already invest effort proportional to their strength of incentives, which is fixed, and their cost of effort. So why these guys are working so hard? Because for them effort is cheap, they're very good at picking strawberries. Why are these guys working so badly? Because for them the costs of effort are very high, and so they don't given the same strength of incentives, they don't bother. Now, why should these guys work a lot harder now that the incentives for managers are introduced than these guys? Because these guys are more interesting for the manager, and the manager will dwell on them, trying to organize them, trying to send them to the most productive strawberry fields, whereas these guys would just be left alone. And once they're left alone, their productivity goes further down. So that's the story of the targeting effect. This is how we know that one way in which incentivized managers can deliver better performance results is by pestering the workers who have the misfortune of being the relatively more productive. Now, this is not the only way to the only mechanism that generates this 20% productivity gain that we observed. The second one is the selection effect. So notice or recall, recall from these data that actually the demand for labor has gone down. So fewer people ended up being employed. You don't need as much labor now that labor is more productive. And the amount of strawberries in the field is obviously the same, not affected by the treatment. So the unemployment has increased. And but the drop in unemployment has not been uniform across the worker productivity distribution. In other words, the workers who the managers knew were productive would experience a relatively small fall in unemployment probability in unemployment, a relatively small increase in unemployment as compared to the workers who the managers knew were useless. So in other words, if your sort of baseline unemployment rate is, let's say, 5% on average, right? So there's a 5% likelihood that you will not be recruited on a certain day. If you are very highly productive employee, then after the introduction of incentives, your baseline unemployment rate will remain still 5%. You're still 5% likely to not be employed, even though you're such a wonderful worker. But if you are a useless worker, your unemployment rate will go up from 5% to, let's say, 20%. You'll be relatively less likely to be employed. Why will you be relatively less likely to be employed? Because you're useless. And managers now have the incentives to maximize the output per acre. And how they do it, they make sure that they hire the best people they can. And given the people that they end up hiring, they will spend more effort and more supervision on the people who are worth it. Now, how do we know this? Let's have a look. Now, these are three groups of workers: the selected in workers, the selected out workers, and the fixed workers. Who are the selected in workers? The selected in workers are the workers who were relatively more likely to be selected. They are relatively more likely to be selected. The selected output workers are relatively less likely to be selected when the managerial incentives were introduced. Who are the fixed workers? The fixed workers are the minority of workers who were not selected when the managerial incentives were introduced. So never mind the part A of this table, you can study it yourself by reading the paper. The most important here is part B of this table. What it says, these are the unemployment rates, the likelihoods of not being employed on a given day by the relatively more productive selected in workers, the relatively less productive selected out workers, and the very unproductive fixed workers. Now, so fixed workers didn't pick strawberries, but they still had a chance of being employed by, you know, shifting boxes and helping with the logistics. That's why they don't have their unemployment rate is less than one. But look here, the relatively productive selected in workers had an increase in unemployment. They became less likely to be employed. So not a good start for our story. But look at the selected output. Look at the selected out workers. The selected out workers experience an even sharper increase in unemployment. So in absolute terms, everybody's employment chances went down. But in relative terms, the employment chances of the selected in workers are better, are relatively better than the employment chances of the selected out workers. They are much less likely to be unemployed than the selected out workers. Why? Because managers now have the incentives, relatively higher incentives to hire these workers rather than the less productive selected out workers. So summing up, you can get performance increases by incentivizing another principal who does not have to be the agent doing the actual work, and these incentives will work when this other principal has better information, more precise signal about the performance and effort of the agent that they manage. So that is typically middle managers, and that's why middle managers very often receive incentives. Now, why would you incentivize middle managers? You would incentivize middle managers because they have better information about the workers' performance. That's basically one of the lessons here. Another lesson, more practical one, is the costs of incentives. The amount of money extra that you have to pay as a firm to incentivize your workers can be reduced by incentivizing managers. So when you incentivize everybody, think about how much your wage will increase. In Lazier's study, it's a wage increase of nearly 11%. It's huge. But when you only incentivize managers, right? If every manager manages, let's say, 10 workers, right? Then you can cut your incentive pay budget almost proportionately. Of course, your productivity gains are unlikely to be as strong as when you incentivize the workers directly. But in terms of cost-benefit analysis, it's very often the case that it's more profitable to incentivize managers rather than workers. And managers deliver higher performance results. Incentivized managers deliver higher performance results in two ways. It's very also important to understand. First, they target the relatively more productive workers. Second, they try to get rid of the relatively less productive workers and try to hire more productive workers more often. So far, so good? Any questions? No? Okay. Now, so let's move on to the differential. So where are we? We looked at individual incentives, Lazier study. We looked at the incentives for managers, the Bandiera, Barankai, and Razul study. Now let's look at the differential effect of incentives framed as gains versus incentives framed as a loss. A very, very interesting topic. It has a lot of connections in the world of psychology, in the world of behavioral economics, and it has a lot of connections with me. I probably told you what my incentive pay contract at this university looks like. Have I? Yes? Good. So this is a very much an incentive contract framed in terms of gains as well as in terms of losses. Now, have you heard about loss aversion? Have you heard about Daniel Kahneman and Amos Tversky? Everybody's heard about Daniel Kahneman and Amos Tversky. I'm sure you have. If not, read up, right? So they came up with this theory of loss aversion. And according to the theory of loss aversion, so if this is your reference point, if this is your sort of current income, right, then the prospect which will increase your income will be valued relatively modestly because your utility is typically concave, you are risk-averse, etc. Risk-averse people have concave utility, so the marginal utility from a positive prospect is positive but not so large. Now let's look at the negative prospect. Let's look at the situation when you stand to lose your wage as compared to status quo. Let's look at the situation when I fail to bring in grant money and my wage will be decreased by 10% in 3 years' time, right? So the same change in wages, the same change in wages will result in a lot larger disutility than here, right? So what does this mean? It means that people will, this theory predicts that people will work a lot harder trying to prevent the loss than they will trying to win the game. Okay? If I tell you I'll give you an extra 10 euros for better performance, yeah, you will deliver some better performance and, you know, you may or may not get your 10 euros depending on how I crafted the incentive scheme. But if I tell you that if you don't deliver this performance outcome that we agree on right now, then I will subtract 10 euros from your earnings. Then this theory predicts, I stress it's a theoretical prediction, The theory predicts that you will work harder. And the only thing that changes is the framing. So far, we looked at incentives that were framed as gains. So far, we looked at incentives in Lazier's study, in Bandiera, Branca, and Rasul's study, and these incentive schemes said, guys, you know, if you work harder, you'll get more money. Here is the incentive scheme that says, guys, if you don't work hard enough, you lose money. The maths, the expectations, the marginal utility business, everything, the participation constraint, the incentive constraint, everything are exactly the same, except that there's a different framing. Here's a very famous study by Tanjim Hossein and John List. Everybody heard about John List? So a major economist from the University of Chicago. They ran a field experiment in a Chinese firm that produces electronics called Van Lida. And this was a very, very famous experiment. It was even featured in The Economist. Not a lot of economics papers are featured in The Economist. So what they did, they had the usual incentives, target bonus. They said, if your average productivity is equal or exceeds a certain target, you will get a bonus of 80 yuan. Very standard target bonus scheme. Lots of papers on this. Okay. Now, they also had this punishment treatment, which is more interesting. They said, they sent a letter to the punishment treatment workers. They sent a letter to them which said, the management of Van Lida has decided to increase your wage by 80 yuan per week. So you've got this wage increase right now. Congratulations. However, if your productivity falls below 400 units per hour, this wage increase will be withdrawn. Now, compare the wording of this treatment and this treatment and express this in terms of expected utility. And you will see that the conditions are mathematically the same. You reach this target, you get this money. You reach this target, you get this money. Except that here it says in words, if you fail to reach this target, you lose the money. So it is this total, it is this purely framing effect, nothing else, is no money. The treatments in terms of monetary implications are exactly the same. But the framing creates a difference between these treatments, which, according to the loss aversion theory, should result in the extra effort by the people in the punishment condition, right? Let us look at the data and see whether it's the case. Now, there is this gift treatment, which I almost forgot about, but it's not very important. Now, here are the results from different specifications, and this is the treatment effect of the reward treatment. If your productivity is 400 or above, you get 80 yuan more. And this is the treatment effect of the punishment treatment, which says if your productivity is less than 400 per hour, then the extra wage that you got given will be withdrawn from you. And as you can see, when you look at the groups, as you can see, there is, you know, a significant difference. It's small in economic terms. We're talking about an extra 1% higher productivity, which is compared to Lazier or Bandiera is nothing, right? But it's statistically significant. And what's even more interesting is that you get this extra 1% productivity from thin air, right? You don't create any scheme, you don't hire any consultants, you don't have any extra wage budget to fund your incentive scheme. None of this. All you need is to cleverly word the letters communicating to the workers the rules according to which their incentives will be paid. And that generates an extra productivity effect, which is consistent with the predictions of the loss aversion theory, because the loss aversion theory says now that you have a salient reference point, your current wage, the gains in wages will lead to a lower effort response than losses in wages. And this insight is validated by the data. Now, if you look at the results, the entire set of results, you'll see that it's not always the case. Right? It's not always the case. Sometimes you don't see significant differences or even lower effects. Sometimes you don't see significant difference between the reward and punishment treatments. And the question is why, right? There are various explanations. So the sort of the loss aversion theory seems to be validated, but the empirical evidence behind this theory in this particular experiment is relatively weak, right? So what are the explanations? Why is the framing... Well, one observation we take from the data is that the significant effect, the significant difference in the effects between the punishment and reward treatments is observed in groups of workers. So there were workers working in groups, some assembly line, and there were workers working as individuals, typically quality controllers and administrators. Now, why were groups more receptive to this framing? Manipulation than were individual workers. There are a couple of explanations which are interesting, but more work is needed to validate them. Now, one explanation is the peer pressure, is the group dynamics, right? So if you have a group which receives a bonus or malus, depending on the group performance, it unites the group. The group becomes more cohesive. In positive as well as negative ways, right? Now, speaking of negative ways in which the group becomes more cohesive, you don't want to be the weak link. You don't want to be the one because of whom your group didn't reach its performance targets and no one got the bonus, right? So this fear of being the weak link, which is labeled as peer pressure in the paper, this fear of being the weak link gave the workers in groups an additional incentive to put in effort. Now, if you're an individual worker, if you screw up, it's your problem and no one else. No one is going to blame you, right? Maybe your family, but they don't know. Yeah? So, but your work colleagues are not going to blame you because you have none. If you don't get your bonus, it's your problem. Your work colleagues, they have their own bonus rules. So you, in terms of peer pressure, this framing manipulation will be stronger in groups than among the individuals. So that's one explanation, which makes sense. So if you really want to make the most of the framing manipulation, if you really want to be so cheeky and sophisticated in your future firms and C&B consultancy projects as to make the most of this pure framing manipulations, you have to think about doing it in teams rather than offering it to individual workers because you want to activate peer pressure as well. Now, another explanation is that it again boils down to team dynamics. So in teams, the performance outcomes of a team are not necessarily the simple additive of the individual contributions, because the psychological processes as well as effort complementarities that exist within teams, they affect the effort levels and attitudes of the team as a whole. So if I work individually, then my emotions, my motivations, my resulting effort is going to affect my own performance. It's not going to affect the performance of the other workers because there's no team. If on the other hand I work in a team, then not only my effort will be affected by my emotions and my attitudes, but also the product of the effort of the other people is going to be affected by my emotions and attitudes. One application of this idea is individual loss aversion. It has to do with how individual loss aversion projects itself to group performance. Now, people differ. It's a well-known fact that people differ in terms of their loss aversion. People differ in terms of the difference between the curvatures to the right and to the left from the from the reference point. In fact, a rational homo economicus is totally indifferent between the gains domain and the loss domain, right? So the rational homo economicus for him, the notion of loss aversion doesn't exist. There are people who are very loss averse for whom this difference is going to be way larger than this difference, okay? So there is a difference in individual perceptions of loss and therefore individual attitudes to loss aversion. How do these differences behave themselves in groups and influence the group decision making? Well, the authors argue that individual loss aversion is magnified by team size, because in the team, if there's one person who is extremely loss averse, then this person is going to be very loud in the team. This person is going to keep saying, guys, we have to work, otherwise we're going to lose our bonus. And it takes only one person in the team who is loss averse to magnify the effect of individual loss aversion beyond what it matters for individual output. So team acts as a sort of magnifier for individual attitudes with respect to loss aversion. That's another explanation. And there is a third explanation, not so interesting, just a demographic explanation. Maybe it's the correct explanation after all, but so this explanation is rather prosaic. It says, well, the fact is that individual workers are older and more experienced at Van Lida, and they're more likely to be men. Now, the demography of loss aversion suggests that it is precisely older, more tenured men who statistically are less prone to loss aversion, right? And if you have individual workers who are older, more experienced, and more men, then they would have low loss aversion to start with, and because they would have low loss aversion to start with, the difference between the punishment and reward framed treatments for these guys is going to be lower. So, I am not young, I am fairly experienced, and I'm a man. I have a punishment treatment from the University of Konstanz, that's how my wage contract is framed. I wonder where my effort response to this contract will be particularly high. I don't know. I need someone to study me as a one observation regression. I think that these incentives are pretty powerful, but by and large, the statistics suggest that it's precisely guys like me who don't care about losses versus gains. Now, let's move on. What do we learn from this particular study? Well, I think the most important lesson we learn is that you can exploit loss aversion. You can exploit the psychological characteristic of loss aversion to generate additional effort by offering incentives framed in terms of losses rather than incentives framed in terms of gains. You will be more successful in doing so when you offer incentives to teams rather than to individual workers. Why? Because in teams there's peer pressure and individual loss aversion attitudes are magnified by team size. These are basically the lessons. Now, let us move to the last part of today's lecture. The last part of today's lecture is about incentives may be too strong. So, in the theory lectures, we learned that incentives may be muted, right? Incentives may be muted by factors like firm size, like uncertainty perceptions. In the performance evaluation lecture, we will also learn about multitasking that also mutes incentives. So we know from theory that incentives may be too weak, right? So people may be extremely risk averse or extremely lazy, in which case the incentives will also be very weak. Now here's a different perspective. What this perspective is saying is that, look here, incentives may actually be too strong for their own good. So this is obviously a more sort of psychology-tinted perspective, which makes it, you know, more interesting, I would say. Now, let us review our basic economics of incentives. What are the assumptions? that permeate the mathematical models of incentives that we have studied so far. The first assumption is look at the incentive constraint. Marginal cost is equal to the strength of incentives. It basically says that the stronger are the incentives, the higher is going to be the effort. So stronger incentives will increase effort. That's assumption number one, which follows from the incentive constraint in the incentives model. And the second assumption is that when you put in more effort, your output will increase. This is the assumption which comes from the production function framework within which we develop the theory of incentives. Now, it turns out that while these assumptions make perfect mathematical sense, in real world, there are nuances which may actually invalidate these assumptions. And some of these we're going to be talking about today. So the first observation that challenges these assumptions is that, well, there is extrinsic and intrinsic motivation. Have you heard of extrinsic and the intrinsic motivation? Extrinsic motivation relates to the reasons for doing things because of some exogenous rewards, like money, like status, like career, like basically money in general sense, right? But there's also intrinsic motivation. You may be doing things because you like to do these things, right? I may be doing teaching because I like to do teaching, all right? So I may be doing research because I like to do research. I mean, after some age, when you have a permanent contract, you don't have material incentives to do research anymore, and yet people do research because they like it. Now, it turns out that when you introduce material incentives, when you introduce monetary incentives, what happens is that the intrinsic motivation that people had to do the work is replaced by the extrinsic motivation to do the work. And it may actually result in negative consequences on the overall performance once material incentives are withdrawn or are so much part of the routine composition of the C&B package that people stop paying attention to them. One particular example is a bonus. Right? So yearly or quarterly bonus is a practice that is very popular in firms. These are incentives that are very, very weak because typically a quarterly or yearly bonus depends on the results of the firm as a whole. So your part of this result in the firm as a whole is very, very small. Your control over firm performance is therefore also very limited unless you're a top manager. And guess what? Statistically, even though people say it's a performance-related bonus, statistically you are 99.999% likely to get this yearly or quarterly bonus at the end of a year or quarter. It's just a fact of life, okay? And at some point, you stop seeing it as an incentive. You start seeing it as an entitlement, and that changes a lot of things. And one thing that it changes is that you stop exerting effort in order to increase the chances of winning this bonus because your perceived chances of winning this bonus are close to one. Another idea that we're going to discuss in the remainder of this lecture is the idea that is labeled in the literature as choking under pressure. You know what choking is? Yeah, so that's choking. And people choke under pressure. What it means is that if incentives are too strong, they freak out. And the third idea that we're going to be talking today is the idea that when you design incentives, you create all sorts of motivations. You don't create a motivation to exert effort. Motivations are typically multidimensional thing, right? The same incentives may create a motivation to exert effort, but a byproduct of this motivation may be a motivation to sabotage, for instance, to look good relative to others, or to do some kind of creative accounting in order to look good on paper and in terms of the performance measure that the principal uses to make a decision about your rewards. So let's look at choking under pressure. Choking under pressure. Well, more than 100 years ago, there were two guys, two American psychologists, Yerkes and Dodson. And they came up with a psychological theory which has since been labeled as the Yerkes-Dodson law. What it says? It says that there is a non-linear relationship between the level of arousal. Well, arousal 100 years ago meant something different from what it means now. It's sort of how your receptive systems are activated to impulses, to influences from outside. So it's basically how excited you are about incentives, right? So there's a non-linear relationship between the level of arousal and the resulting performance. So when arousal is low, when you don't really care about incentives, when incentives are very weak, your performance result is also very weak. You just don't care, right? When things are more interesting, when you get a little bit of incentives going, you respond. You start working a bit harder. Stronger incentives, you start working even harder. But when incentives are super strong, you freak out. Yes, you are very motivated, you're very motivated, you are very aroused, you're very alert, but you freak out because you choke under pressure. The example that I like to give at this point in the lecture is the example of performing musicians. So those of you who went to musical school and did public performances, they may recall this feeling of sweaty hands each time there is a public performance. I went to musical school, I played the guitar, and I performed in public from time to time. And I would play my pieces very well in the privacy of my home. But when I had to play before hundreds of people, I would discover sweaty hands. And you can't play guitar with sweaty hands, you know, you can't. So my hands were sweaty and they were trembling. And needless to say, my music wasn't as good as, I could potentially play. So I was very aroused, very excited, wanted to impress lots of people. Quality of my performance, very low. Lower than the quality of my performance when I was just in my bedroom, right? So you can choke under pressure. You can freak out. And how do we know that you can choke under pressure and can freak out? Not only from Nick's individual account, you can also learn it from empirical studies. And here's a very famous paper, also featured in The Economist, I think. Dan Ariely, Uri Gnisi, George Lowenstein, and Nina Mazar. All these people are very, very famous psychologists. Dan Ariely is particularly famous. The Upside of Irrationality is a famous book that he wrote. Read it on the plane. Very, very interesting book. So they wrote this very famous paper called Large Stakes and Big Mistakes, where they showed in a sequence of experiments, it wasn't just one experiment, they showed in a sequence of experiments that choking under pressure does exist as an empirical phenomenon, and that people do choke under pressure, and that incentives can sometimes be too strong. So there were, I think, four or five experiments in this paper. The first experiment they featured was an experiment involving 87 participants in rural India, and the task was to play six different games in random order. So they basically got them, got the village population, and they offered them three conditions: the low incentives, they could win 4 rupees per game, depending on the performance; the moderate incentives, 40 rupees, quite a lot more; and super high incentives, 400 rupees per game. Now, the classical theory of incentives would predict that the performance of people in the game would be best under high incentives and the worst under low incentives. The data, the evidence is not consistent with this prediction. So these are the regression results which show performance in the mid incentives and high incentives conditions relative to the low incentives conditions. So it's how well or badly people performed in the game relative to the low incentives conditions. So these are the various games that they got them to play. And what you can see is that in a number of games, right, in a number of games, people in high conditions where they could win an amount of money that is commensurate with how much they would spend on their grocery shopping per month. It's quite a lot of money, right? And yet, their performance in these games were actually worse in many cases than the performance of the people in the same games under low incentive conditions. How do you make sense of this? The economic theory says higher incentives, better performance. The empirical evidence says higher incentives, worse performance, right? The way to rationalize these findings is to say, well, yes, you can choke under pressure. And that has important implications. That has important implications for the design of incentive schemes. One implication is that obviously you shouldn't make your incentives too strong. My understanding of your point is that part of the reason why we have this negative, counterintuitive negative effect is that people thought that they were very unlikely to excel in the game so much as to win these prizes. Now, what can I say in response to this explanation? You can email it to Dan Ariely as well and see what he says. But what I can say in response to this comment is that, well, we're talking about a particular game with a particular set of rules. So, and the performance in the games were standard. The rules of performance in the games were standard. They were, of course, specific to each game, and I obviously don't remember them for all six games, but they were the same. So you have to do absolutely the same. You have to reach absolutely the same level of performance in order to get 4 rupees in the low treatment, 40 rupees in the mid treatment, and 400 rupees in the high treatment. You didn't have to have done better to win 400 rupees. Right. There were 87 people. Each of them had to play these six games in random order. And the strength of incentives and the order of the game was varied within individuals. So you would get, for instance, you would get first to play packing orders. First you'd get to play packing quarters under low incentives. Then randomly you would be assigned to play labyrinth under high incentives.
Okay,
then you. No, it would vary, right? Now, a variant of your explanation, which I find very insightful, actually, you know, a variant of your explanation could be that people may have perceived that, you know, the experimenters were unlikely to pay them so much money. They just didn't believe they could win so much money from playing this game, right? It's a rural India, right? It's a very specific context. You had these aliens coming and, getting them to play these games. So the context is very specific, and there could be all sorts of beliefs and perceptions that could hamper or that could have hampered or quite rationally reduced the effort of people under low anticipation that they would ever get these 400 rupees per game. So, right, it's possible. That's why it's not the only experiment in this paper. It wouldn't have been so famous from just one of these experiments. Right. Now, there is also, as I said, a very specific context. So, another experiment that they tried was not in rural India, it was at Massachusetts Institute of Technology, right? So, brainy students, and they were offered low incentives and high incentives for doing two types of tasks. So, it was a 2x2 design. Now, so there was the simple task and there was the complicated task. So the simple task was just you have to press button as quickly as possible after a signal, and you would be paid depending on the time difference between hearing the signal and pressing the button. So beep, 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 you'd have to, right? So it's not a very cognitive task, but it requires effort. You need to be alert, and so you should have some Yerkes Dodson in this task, right? Now, there was the cognitive task also. The cognitive task was adding numbers, right? It wasn't physically demanding, but it was very demanding cognitively, right? And there were the low incentive treatment and the high incentive treatment. Now, this experiment is more interesting because it gives an additional margin with which to study the implications of Yerkes and Dodson. In rural India experiments, all these games were, you know, they would require, most of them would require, I would say, cognitive effort, even though they were some purely physical games. But here you would have clearly defined cognitive task and physical task. So these are the regression results. And what we see, well, to be able to interpret these regression results, you need to be aware of these cross products. Now, the dependent variable here is the performance in the standardized performance in both tasks. So because every participant would have to do both tasks, right? So when you offered high payment, then your performance increases. See, there's a significant positive coefficient. So far, so good. So far, so consistent with the basic theory of incentives. However, look here. If you are offered high payment for adding task versus high payment for physical task, the performance gain from caused by offering high payment in the additive task, in the adding task, is equal to the sum of these two, is equal to minus 20% or so, right? So in the physical task, your performance increases when you offer stronger incentives. In the cognitive task, your performance deteriorates when you offer strong incentives. Why? Let's go back to Yerkes and Dodson. Yerkes and Dodson law also says that the optimal arousal point varies depending on the nature of the task. So when you have a difficult cognitive task, which requires a lot of memory, decision making, and multitasking to complete, then the optimal level of arousal at this task is not so high. Right? When you play music, which requires a lot of attention, multitasking, decision-making, etc., your level of arousal shouldn't be very high, otherwise you'll have sweaty hands and screw up. Right? But when you do a simple task, which doesn't require a lot of cognitive resources to complete, then the optimal point of arousal is higher. So what Yerkes and Dodson says, in theory, it says that for cognitive tasks, you should offer not so high incentives, otherwise people will freak out. For simple tasks, you could offer stronger incentives. That's what Yerkes and Dodson said more than 100 years ago. Now, to get back to the MIT experiment, what we observe is that for the simple task, pressing the button after a peep, you can increase arousal. And this increase in arousal by offering higher incentives will be productive for the simple physical task. However, the same strategy will be counterproductive in the case of the cognitive task, because in the case of the cognitive task, the optimal arousal point is a lot lower, right? So stronger incentives improve performance in the simple task, but worsen it in a difficult task. Why? Because in consistence with the Yerkes and Dodson theory, high level of arousal impairs the other faculties of your brain and body which are required to carry out this task. In order to minimize this impairment, you have to control the level of arousal and not let it be too high. Okay, another experiment takes a different perspective from Yerkes and Dodson. It looks at what happens when you raise the level of arousal, when you increase the level of arousal, not by offering high monetary incentives, but by basically multiplying the stakes, increasing the stakes. And what was the treatment here? The treatment here was doing the task in private, in some sort of cubicle where no one could see you, versus doing the same task in public where people could see you, right? And the task was solving anagrams. It's a cognitively intensive task. It's not pressing the button. You need to, you know, think, and a lot of cognitive resources are required there. And what you see here is that when When you have the same task performed in public, the performance at this anagram solving task goes down. So it's very much like playing music in public versus playing music in private. You get so aroused, you get so excited that basically the limited cognitive resources of your brain become insufficient to carry out the task at the level of quality and sophistication that is required. So, bottom line, it looks like incentives can be too strong in the sense that they can lead to a suboptimally high level of arousal, which according to Yorks-Dodson law will impair performance, and the more so when the task requires a considerable expenditure of cognitive resources, right? So incentives are great. Incentives increase performance, incentives increase effort. However, in some situations, when they make you too aroused for your own good, the actual performance may actually suffer. So people can choke under pressure, and to reduce the propensity for choking under pressure, maybe paying flat wages might be optimal, especially for doing cognitively involved tasks. That's the implication. So next time you look at the firms who are your customers in your C&B business, and you will see that they neither have nor particularly want to introduce strong incentives, don't become too aroused in your sales pitch to sell them incentive packages. Try to understand why. And the answer why some firms don't have very strong incentives for some occupations is because they don't want people to choke under pressure. Okay, now, so in the remaining 5 minutes, I'd like to talk about the dark side of incentives. I'd like to talk about another idea why incentives may be too strong, and it has nothing to do with arousal, it has nothing to do with Yorks and Dodson, it has all to do with dysfunctional behavioral responses. So by offering incentives, we think that we create motivation for people to exert effort in very particular set of dimensions. But it turns out that we've forgotten something. It turns out that we have forgotten to think about other dimensions of effort that our incentives may stimulate, whose product may not be so beneficial for our purposes. Think about the Hanoi rat massacre, the example I gave in the beginning, right? So they wanted to get rid of rats in Hanoi, and they introduced incentives per part of rat's body, right? So far, so good. What they have forgotten to do, what they've forgotten to think about is that, well, maybe, you know, their incentives, the way they were administered, would create incentives along other dimensions of effort, and that could screw things up in a big way. Okay, to move from Hanoi in early 20th century to the height or the aftermath of the recent financial crisis, here is a quotation from a Forbes journal article, Forbes magazine article, which sort of criticizes the way incentives are offered in large organizations. And there is a lot to criticize. There's a lot to criticize in how incentives are offered in large organizations, because large organizations have a very acute problem of how to measure performance. And that's why they have thousands of different metrics, most of them accounting-based, that requires a lot of cognitive resources and a lot of planning to organize and to incentivize in the right way. And no matter how clever you think you are in designing your incentive packages, the agents will very often be even smarter than you in trying to game the system of incentives that you introduce to them. We will see some of the examples here. I will skip some of the stuff because of the time pressure. Well, here's one illustration which I think is worth 1,000 words. Here's a distribution. I took it from the Office of Educational Quality Control of the United Kingdom. These are the people not necessarily school leavers in England, taking a high school level exam in English language. So you could get a maximum of 200 points for this exam, and the grading rules are such that these are the boundaries for the grade A plus, A, etc., etc. Now, what matters for university admission is not the points, how the points that you get, but the grade that you get, which is, I think, a bit silly, but it's true, right? And look here. The distribution is sort of quasi-normal. It's not really normal, right? But it looks sort of quasi-normal. Eh? But look at these interesting aberrations. You know, just before the cutoff between grade A and B, you have this unusual increase in the mass of observations, right? If the distribution were perfectly normal, then you would have it like this. Where does this mass come from? These are the additional people who received 1, 2, or 3 more points above the cutoff grade by 180. So they would have get 180 or less, right? But 180 is the cutoff between B and A. And you would rather have an A, because when you get an A, you can get into a better university. When you have a B, it doesn't matter whether you get a B for 179 or an A for 181. If you get an A for 181, you get to a better university. If you have a G, if you have a B for 179, you won't get to a better university. So some guys somehow managed to get just above the cutoff, right? So there is an incentive. The incentive is you have to work hard, you have to know your English. The better you know your English, the higher your exam grade will be. One problem with this scheme is that there are grades rather than points. And the cutoff grade, the cutoffs between different grades create perverse incentives for people to somehow try to game the system in order to get just above the cutoff for A. You see the same story. You see the same story with B. Now with C, it's not so important anymore. With C, it's not so important because when you get a C, it's basically you go nowhere. You go to do some manual work or whatever, right? So it's not the university level. But when it really matters, then we see very interesting results, which suggests that incentives are gained on a routine basis. And it doesn't have to be material. It doesn't have to be monetary incentives in firms. It's a much more general point that we're making in this lecture. Now, let us look finally at one paper that makes this point even stronger. It says that incentives can actually result in totally dysfunctional behavioral responses. So here, people don't make anyone worse off. They make themselves better off, and they put a little bit of pressure on the university system. But it's by and large, it's not criminal, right? But here's an experiment where people actually engage in counterproductive behavior, which increases their gains, but decreases the overall performance of the sort of organization that the authors of this experimental study created. So it's, of course, it's a lab experiment, no real firm, nothing. But they had treatments where people were and were not allowed or had no incentive to engage in one particular counterproductive behavior, which is sabotage. So there were several treatments. The most important treatment is the sabotage treatment. There was a task, there was a fixed wage. In the sabotage treatment, you could sabotage at the cost. So what does it mean? You could pay some experimental currency units from your budget in order to artificially reduce the effort of the other people, in order to look good relative to them. Now, notice, interestingly, that it's fixed wage and no performance feedback in the baseline. In the ranking, there is relative performance, but no material incentives. So this is an experiment where there is no material incentives. The only incentive there is to look good in terms of performance ranking. pathetic. You know, 1 hour lab experiment, what are you talking about? It doesn't matter whether you're top five or top 10 or bottom 95, right? So yet people did engage in counterproductive behaviors as we see here. So this is the number of periods that the experimental task, the experiment was ongoing and the experimental task was played. And this is the average performance in the task in different experimental treatments. So this is baseline, where people have fixed wage and no feedback, they have no incentives whatsoever, so the performance is, yes, the performance is pretty bad. The highest performance is observed when you introduce incentives, so incentives work, so far so good. But in this treatment, you can't sabotage. When you do exactly the same, except that now you allow for sabotage, people really take advantage of this option in order to look better relative to their teammates. But by doing so, they reduce their output so that the overall output, the average output of the team, goes down. So look here, you introduce incentives, non-monetary admittedly, but still, you introduce incentives, it creates a massive performance effect, but half of this effect, or even more than half of this effect, is taken away by dysfunctional behavioral responses. So that's why you don't really have incentives practiced in 100% of firms, in 100% of cases, for a variety of reasons. One of these reasons is that the performance effect of incentives may be greatly reduced by dysfunctional behavioral responses that these same incentives create. People become to sabotage, people may refuse to cooperate with one another, people can freak out and choke under pressure. People can engage in all sorts of nefarious activity, as I was planning to show with this paper, which shows that basically the more the stronger CEO incentives are, the more likely it is that their firm is going to be investigated for financial fraud. Check this out. It's a top journal and a very interesting story. So our lecture is coming to an end. Let's wrap up. What was the point of this lecture? The point of this lecture was to show a few pieces of empirical evidence that illustrates the various aspects of the of how incentives work in reality. Now, do incentives work? Yes, they do. We've seen Lazier, huge productivity effect. Even this last study by Charnes and colleagues, Charnes, Villeval, and Maslet. So even in this study, which invited dysfunctional behavioral responses, incentives work. Bandiera, Barankai, Rasul, incentives work. So the question is not whether incentives work or not. Incentives do work. The question is how incentives work. And we've seen that incentives work through selection effect and through incentive effect. They also work through targeting effect and, again, selection effect in Bandiera, Barankai, and Rasul. You can gain additional performance, you can gain additional mileage from your incentive schemes by framing incentives in terms of losses rather than in terms of gains. This little trick works better when you offer incentives to teams rather than to individual workers through largely psychological mechanisms, such as peer pressure and team magnifying the effect of individual loss aversion. We have also seen that incentives may backfire by creating dysfunctional behavioral response and motivating people to engage in the sorts of behaviors that are productive to them individually, but actually counterproductive to the principle. So, yeah. Should incentives be implemented in organizations? Yes, I think they should. They should be, but not always. If you think that incentives are too strong, or if you think that incentives are prone to abuse through dysfunctional behavior, then it's better to withdraw incentives or reconsider the existing incentive schemes rather than carrying on with them, arguing that incentives work everywhere and to the same extent. Thank you for your attention and see you later today.